Mr. Wine. I want also to thank Mr. Meskin for taking us here this evening. I'm always reminded, my dear friends, of a remark by our president, Dr. Belkin Oliver Shalom. He once said something I think very profound, which I think we may find as a kind of leitmotif for these two lectures which I'll be giving. He said that Ribbono Shel Olam has given us two great gifts, the gift to forget and the gift to remember. The gift to forget enables us to surmount our sorrows, and the gift to remember enables us to prevent their recurrence. That, I think, is what's behind the study of history. And I hope that you will follow me this evening and again when I give the second lecture in considering a chapter in Jewish history from which I think we have a lot to learn. Because if we don't learn, unfortunately, we may be condemned to repeat it. A remark of Elie Wiesel comes to mind. The most precious gift, he says, the most precious gift, he says, a parent can give to his or her child is a past, a knowledge of the whence wherewith most wisely to confront the whither. Bathsheba Singer once remarked that Jews have suffered from many diseases, but amnesia is not one of them. They once asked Chaim Weizmann in the years before the creation of the State of Israel, one of these UN commissions asked him, by what right do you Jews claim a Jewish state? And he answered, by the right of remembrance, because we haven't forgotten. Exile, said the Baal Shem Tov, is prolonged through forgetfulness. But in remembrance lies the secret of redemption. They tell the story of Morris Raphael Cohen, the professor of philosophy at City College, who was once asked to give a lecture on the subject that I am giving this evening, namely anti-Semitism. And he got up and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, there is no Jewish problem," and he sat right down. "There is only a Gentile problem." I'm afraid that we cannot very much influence the Gentiles, although perhaps I'll have something to say about that later on, but I think we can say something to ourselves, and perhaps this problem is one which we can address. Why are the Jews hated? Why have they been hated through the years, and in particular the centuries which I deal with, from the time of Alexander the Great, who died in the year 323 BCE, to the time of Justinian, the 6th century CE? It so happens that we can, I think, divide this topic, like Gaul, into three parts. There is anti-Semitism on the part of governments, anti-Semitism on the part of the masses, and anti-Semitism on the part of intellectuals. Now, the first of these, anti-Semitism, of course, I might say parenthetically that we really shouldn't use the term anti-Semitism. You know why? Because Semitic is really a linguistic term. You can't talk about anti-Semitism. There's no hatred of the languages. It's rather the hatred of the people. So therefore, what the people believe is what people may hate. Hence, we should not talk about anti-Semitism, but anti-Judaism or anti-Jewish feeling. But the term is so widespread that perhaps we continue to use it nonetheless. Now, let's continue the first of these types of anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism by governments. You find that in the period that we're talking about, there is one characteristic which I think pervades Jewish history throughout this period, and I might say through most of the Middle Ages, I don't say all of the Middle Ages, and even into modern times. And that is what I have termed a vertical alliance. In other words, by and large, there is an alliance between the governments and the Jews. The governments need the Jews need the government. Now why? And this is, I think, the first and most important lesson that I have to teach this evening. The Jews are strong. The Jews are numerous. The Jews are united. And the Jews have leadership. That's why the governments respect them. And even if occasionally, as we'll see, there are outbreaks against the Jews, the outbreaks are only momentary, and the Jews recover very, very quickly. If you take a look, for example, we're all acquainted with the story in the Megillah, Megillus Esther. There was an outbreak against the Jews, certainly, but it didn't last very long. And why? Because the Jews were numerous. They were found throughout the Persian Empire. The Jews were important economically, and the Jews had leadership. And as a result, the leadership of the Persian government could not, for very long, continue a policy of hatred and obliteration of the Jews. And that is true also of the time of Alexander the Great and of his successors. I might say, parenthetically here, that I was once asked the question, who was the greatest reformer in Jewish history? I'll put it to you in the audience. Who was the greatest reformer in Jewish history? The answer I will give is Alexander the Great, a non-Jew, because he changed the whole course of Jewish history in the sense that he spread the Greek language, the Greek culture, and in effect, he enticed many Jews to consider Greek culture as something they could reconcile with their Judaism. This was a tremendous challenge. But the fact of the matter is that Alexander the Great realized, and his successors realized, that they were a minority in their own empire. After all, the great majority of the people in Alexander's empire were not Greeks or Macedonians. And the same thing was true of Alexander's successors. The great majority were not Syrians or Egyptians or Macedonians. The Jews were so numerous, we have reason to think that at the period that we're talking about, we even have censuses that were taken during this period, the Jews were at least 10% of the population of the world that we're considering, the Mediterranean world and beyond. The Jews were too numerous. The problem, one problem that we Jews today have is that we are an endangered species. I once was teaching a class in the City University during the summer, and was a class that I could see from the faces that these were non-Jews. It was a course in the history of civilization. And we came to what the textbook called the Hebrews. So listen to this. I asked the students, by the way, what percentage of the world's population today is Jewish? So I turned to the first student. So he said, 33 1/3%. So I said, how'd you get that? So he said, well, there are Catholics, there are Protestants, and there are Jews. Now, my dear friends, the Jews today are an endangered species. 1/4 of 1% of the world's population. The fact is that in the period we're talking about, the Jews were, I'd say, at least 10% of the population. They were too important. And moreover, the government was itself a minority government. In Egypt, for example, what percentage of the rulers were, as you know, Macedonians and Greeks, what percentage of the people in Egypt were Greeks or Macedonians? We estimate perhaps 10%. What percentage of the population of Egypt was Jewish? So we estimate about 15%. So the Jews were very effective as middlemen, same position which they held, I might say, in the Middle Ages under the Muslims to a considerable degree as well. So the rulers understood that the Jews were too numerous. The Jews were also important in the running of the government, because the fact is that you had a bureaucracy, a tremendous bureaucracy in these countries. The Jews were to a high degree literate. The Jews kept the records. The Jews were loyal. We know that the Jews were policemen. We even know that Jews were favored as soldiers. The Jews were known as very brave soldiers, even under the Persians. We know that Jews marched in Xerxes' army, for example. The Jews guarded the frontier of Egypt with with Sudan in this period of the 6th to the 4th century. The Jews were part of Alexander's army. So the Jews were therefore very important in running the government, especially since the masses of the people who were being run by the Egyptian rulers and by the Syrian rulers were themselves, of course, not Greeks. So therefore, they favored the Jews. They gave the Jews certain privileges. Let me give you an example, which is not, I think, generally known. We know the story of Hanukkah and how the Syrian ruler, who was Antiochus Epiphanes, issued decrees forbidding the practice of Judaism. Do you realize that Antiochus Epiphanes' father, Antiochus III, actually favored the Jews, even permitted the Jews to be free of paying taxes for 3 years, permitted the priests, the Kohanim, to be free of paying taxes forever, permitted the Jews even to bring funds into the temple from all over, and forbade, I might say, bringing animals that were not kosher animals into the city of Jerusalem because the Jews didn't want such animals. And why did he do that? Because he realized that he needed the help of the Jews, who were important since he himself, being a Greek, was a minority in his own realm. Antiochus Epiphanes issued the decrees not so much because he was anti-Jewish as because the rulers of the Jews, or de facto the rulers of the Jews, the high priests, enticed him. Actually, they were competing with one another, trying to win his favor. And he figured, well, if they're trying to get my favor, and they're willing to offer me funds, and he needed funds to fight his various wars with the Egyptians, with the Parthians, and then so on, the Romans, so therefore he succumbed. The fact is that Antiochus Epiphanes did not issue his decrees against the Jews of Syria, but only against the Jews of Judea, because the high priests, in effect, wanted to Hellenize the country. Now, when you have outbreaks of anti-Semitism on the part of rulers, and let me give you, again, a couple of examples where it actually does occur, I think it's instructive to understand why the outbreaks occur and why they don't last. Now, there's one case where there's a ruler of Egypt, Ptolemy IV, who fights against the Syrians and defeats the Syrians and then takes over the land of Israel. Israel, this is during the 3rd century BCE, when Israel was more or less, you might say, up for grabs between these two nations, Egypt and Syria. And the Egyptian ruler Ptolemy wins the war. He comes to Jerusalem, and of course, what's the most celebrated building in Jerusalem? The temple. And he wants to enter the temple. And of course, they tell him, I'm sorry, but you know, we don't allow a non-Jew to enter the temple. We don't even allow a non-priest to enter the temple. We don't even allow any priest to enter the Holy of Holies except on Yom Kippur. So how can we allow you? But he says, what do you mean? Why are you discriminating against me, etc.? And what happens is he decides he's going to enter the temple no matter what. And when he enters the temple, somehow, miraculously, he is knocked down somehow or other, and he is not able to go through with it. He decides that he has to teach the Jews a lesson. So when he comes back to Egypt, what he does is he subjects the Jews to a poll tax, even though prior to that the Jews were free of such taxes. Then he subjects the Jews to the status of slaves. He's going to repeat the pharaohs. Then he decides he's going to brand the Jews, actually going to brand their arms, sounds familiar to us, brand their arms with the ivy leaf. Now the ivy leaf was the symbol of the god Dionysus, right? And if they agreed, he says, to worship the mysteries, which he favored, the Greek mysteries, then they will have equal citizenship. Otherwise, they will be subjected to this great disgrace. The majority of the Jews refuse. Now that's a very important point to bear in mind, that here in Egypt, mind you, this is in the 3rd century BCE, the Jews who are separated from the land of Israel defy the ruler himself because they are loyal to their Judaism. Thereupon, Ptolemy decides he has to teach the Jews a further lesson. So what he does is he decides that he's going to massacre all the Jews. And he goes even further. He says, those who shelter Jews, and again, this will sound very familiar to us who are acquainted with the events of our own day. Those who shelter the Jews, whether old people or even infants, will be tortured to death. Any who give information to turn in Jews will receive the property of the Jews whom they have turned in, plus a gift of 2,000 drachmas, a huge sum in those days, from the royal treasury. And every person who is sheltering a Jew will be burned to death. Whereupon we find that the Gentiles rejoice because now they can turn in the Jews, they can get the Jewish property, and we find here, in effect, a massive attempt to destroy the Jewish community of Egypt, the largest Jewish community of the world at that time, or certainly of the world outside Eretz Yisrael, because we have a figure in study from Philo that there were about 1 million Jews living in Egypt in his day, about a century later. Now what happens is that the king then tells his soldiers that the method by which he's going to kill all the Jews is he's going to get hundreds of elephants drunk, and these elephants are then going to be instructed to trample the Jews to death. So he gives the orders, and they get together these hundreds of elephants. They get the elephants drunk, and then they give the order to the elephants to trample on the Jews. Now, they give the order to the elephants in Greek. Apparently, it was Greek to the elephants. No, I'm serious. It was Greek to the elephants, because what happens is that the elephants, instead of trampling the Jews, turn around and trample the ones who are giving the orders. Whereupon the king sees there's something here that he had not expected. And he came to the conclusion, apparently he came to his senses, that these people are too numerous, A. B, that they have somebody on their side. We say, Rabbeinu Shalom, whatever it is, he decides to complete 180 degree about face and decides to form an alliance with the Jews. Now, what's interesting here is that the idea of destroying the Jews, as I say, step by step, getting the masses involved in it, and even, he says, the Jews were to be treated like wild animals, right? Again, try to make them dehumanized, right? And the fact is that it didn't work. Now, the reason why it didn't work was because the Jews were too numerous, the Jews were too loyal, the Jews were ready to die for their principles, and apparently the king was impressed by that and decided these people are people that I should have on my side. Formed an alliance with them, and thereafter we find that the attitude continues, which had prevailed before that time. Namely, the Jews are the ones who are trusted by the rulers, the Jews are the bureaucrats, the Jews are the policemen, the Jews are the tax collectors, the Jews are even commanders-in-chief of the army. We even hear, you wouldn't believe this, that during the period we're talking about, in the 2nd century BCE, we find that there were 4 Jews who were commanders-in-chief of the armies of the Egyptian Ptolemies. What more can you ask? Now what happens is, again, another event which seems to interrupt this, you might say, euphoria on the part of the Jews. Namely, in the 2nd century, a king dies, and in those days, when the king died, the family would very often fight a dynastic war. Well, what happened was the king who died was succeeded by his widow, who wanted to have her son succeed to the throne. But the king who died had a brother who wanted to have the throne, and so there was a civil war between the brother of the deceased king and the widow and the son of the one who had died. Now, in that particular war, it's very interesting that the Jew who was at that time commander-in-chief of the army, of the Egyptian army, was true to the king, in this case the queen and her son, true to the, you might say, legitimate rulers, and as a result, even though he was true to the legitimate rulers, he was defeated by this brother of the deceased king. Now, when the brother won the war, he decided he's going to teach these Jews a lesson. Now, what you find here is very interesting. Actually, what had the Jews done in this dynastic war? Really nothing. It was really a single person, namely the commander-in-chief of the army, who happened to be Jewish. But because he was the commander-in-chief, and because he was a Jew, the Jews are blamed. And so the king says he's going to teach all the Jews a lesson. And he does exactly the same thing that had been done in the century before. Gets all the Jews, incidentally, gets them all naked and in chains, men, women, and children. He's going to wipe them all out. Again, the method, elephants. Again, gets them drunk. And again, the same thing. Gives the orders in Greek. It's Greek to the elephants. They don't know. And they turn around. They kill the people who are giving the orders. Whereupon, again, the king realizes, look, this is not the way. It's not going to work. These people are too loyal to their beliefs. These people are too united. They're too numerous. They're too powerful. The best thing you can do is to form an alliance with them, or to renew the alliance with them. And so what he does is he appoints another Jew to be commander-in-chief of his army. Now, there are other instances which I can mention, which I think illustrate the problem of the Jew. The main problem of the Jew in those days is very similar to a problem that Jews in our own day have. And that is the charge of dual loyalty. In other words, the question is, at what point, if you are living in Egypt, and you are even a citizen of Egypt, because we have reason to think, Josephus says the Jews were actually citizens in Egypt, if you are living in Egypt, are you loyal to Egypt, to the ruler of Egypt, or because you're a Jew, are you loyal to the ruler of Judea? Because don't forget, during the period that we're talking about, a Jewish state was established. In the middle of the 2nd century BCE, the Maccabees established a Jewish state. So where does your loyalty lie? And suppose you have to choose, then where do you choose? Now, there are three instances where, indeed, the Jews of Egypt had to choose. Now, in each instance, what's very interesting is that the ones who have to choose are the Jews who are in the Egyptian army, fighting for the Egyptians. And yet, in the first case, what happens is the ruler of Egypt, who in that case was Cleopatra, not the famous or the infamous Cleopatra, but one of her predecessors, Cleopatra decides that the ruler of Judea, who was Alexander Junius, was getting too powerful, too ambitious, trying to conquer too much, and the best thing to do is to teach him a lesson. To go to war against him and to defeat him, to stop him in his tracks. She then goes to her commander-in-chief, who happens to be a Jew. And she tells him, we have to go to war against Alexander Junius. And he says, if you go to war against Alexander Junius, your own soldiers, your most loyal soldiers, who happen to be Jews, and the Jews were, I might say, in the most sensitive place, namely on the frontier. And we know instantly there were Jewish regiments of soldiers, so the Jews were able to observe Kashrut, Shabbat even. The fact is, he says, your own soldiers will not listen to your own commands. They will not fight against a fellow Jew. She apparently realized that this commander knew what he was talking about, and so she gave up the idea, and again she formed an alliance with Alexander Junius. Again, illustrating the power of the Jews, the power of the Jewish leadership, the loyalty, the unity of the Jews. A second case occurred a number of years later. This was in the year 55 BCE. The Roman governor of Syria, whose name was Gabinius, was coming down to Egypt in order to install as the king of Egypt Ptolemy the 11th. He had to come down from Syria. If you look at your map, you'll see you come down from Syria through Eretz Yisrael, and then you come to the frontier. Guarding the frontier, of course, are the Jewish soldiers. And they would obviously not allow a foreigner to come in. This was, after all, a Roman. How could they allow him to enter? So what Gabinius does is he takes with him a Jew whose name is Antipater. This is Antipater, the father of Herod, the infamous Herod. And Antipater then comes to the frontier and he addresses the Jewish soldiers in the Egyptian army. And he says, I, a fellow Jew, ask you please to allow Gabinius, the Roman governor, to enter Egypt. And they listen to him because they feel a tie to a fellow Jew. And they allow him to enter. And nothing is done, incidentally, against the Jewish soldiers. Nothing is done at all. A third case, a few years later, in the year 48, Julius Caesar is fighting a civil war against Pompey. Julius Caesar's in Egypt. He needs help. Again, the Roman governor comes down, comes through Eretz Yisrael. Again, Antipater comes with him, and this time takes with him the Kohen Gadol, Hyrcanus. And Hyrcanus, the high priest, addresses the soldiers and says, I, as Kohen Gadol, ask you please to allow these Roman soldiers to enter to help Julius Caesar. They do, and again, nothing is done to them because they realize the loyalty and the prominence and importance of the Jews. I think that we can say that this problem, however, does not go away so easily. And if you read the essay by Josephus against Appian, the anti-Semite, you realize that this charge of dual loyalty is one that comes up again and again. Appian says the Jews are not deserving to be citizens. They do not worship the same gods as the Alexandrians. Now, you see, that's an important point, because in antiquity, you never had a separation of church and state. So therefore, in effect, if you did not accept the religion of the state, then you were not saluting the flag, as it were. There was always a big problem, I might say, especially in the Roman Empire too, namely that the Roman Empire consisted of many peoples. The Romans themselves were a minority in their own empire. As you know, Latin was spoken by only a minority of people in the Roman Empire. And therefore, how can you, in effect, have any kind of unity in this empire? So the one thing which did unite the empire was they had a common religion. And the common religion consisted of the worship of the gods, the traditional gods, and of the emperor. The Jews did not and could not, of course. Now, one other factor I think that we have to consider in the causes of anti-Semitism by governments is an economic factor, which I've already alluded to. The fact that Jews were always permitted to send the half shekel, each adult male Jew, to the temple in Jerusalem. As a result, the temple was a tremendous bank. And at the time when the government of Rome was actually in a shortage of money, we find that Jews were shipping money. We have a famous case by Cicero, which he defends a client who's accused of extorting money which was collected by the Jews for shipping to Jerusalem. And he says, well, what's the charge against this fellow Flaccus? I mean, after all, he should be favored by you. He did you a great favor because he prevented money from being sent out of the country to some foreign country. You find that, I might say, repeated by Titus, the Roman general, later emperor. He says the Jews get rich at our expense. And Tacitus, the Roman historian, the end of the first, beginning of the second century, says the same thing. The Jews collect money and they increase the wealth of some temple at the expense of the Romans themselves. I want to deal finally with one other case, or I should say three other cases of the same sort, where the governments are involved in anti-Semitism, and that is expulsion of the Jews from Rome. Now, we have information that in three instances, in the year 139 BCE, in the year 19 CE, and in the reign of the Emperor Claudius, which would be in the 40s CE, the Jews, meaning all the Jews of the city of Rome, were expelled. Do you have any idea how many Jews were living in Rome during this period? Those of you who go to Rome, as you know, there are catacombs, which you may visit now, and you can see the Jews of Rome were a very large community. We estimate that in the period that we're talking about, certainly in the first century CE, the Jews numbered as many as 40 or 50,000, right? So the Jews are expelled from Rome. Why are they expelled from Rome? In each case, or certainly in the first two cases, it's because of proselytism. The Jews are accused of trying to convert non-Jews to Judaism. Now, we'll come back to that in my next lecture when I deal with the love of the Jews, because the Jews during this period were apparently attracting large numbers to Judaism. But in any case, they're accused of trying to undermine the Roman religion. The Roman religion, say the Romans, had given them the ascendancy in the world, and now the Jews are trying to destroy that. So they're expelled. 139, again in the year 19, the same accusation. And in the time of the Emperor Claudius, we hear that they're making a tumult under a person they call Crestus. Now, that may be, of course, a misspelling for a reference to the founder of Christianity. There's a great dispute about that. But in any case, most people assume that it's the great uproar that they're causing, again, is because they're trying to convert people to Judaism or a form of Judaism. As you know, at that particular time, there was no separation between Judaism and Christianity. In any case, the Jews are expelled. The Jews are expelled. And what happens after each case? The Jews come right back. The governments welcome them back. Why? Because the Jews are too important. They're too important politically, they're too important economically, and the Jews are united, they're loyal, and they have leadership. The fact is that during this period, various writers that we have, and I might say if you're interested in the subject, there is a magnificent work that was done by Menachem Stern, collecting all the references to the Jews in Greek and Latin literature. This is Menachem Stern, incidentally, who was murdered a few years ago on his way to the library of the Hebrew University. So you take a look at those writings or the fragments that have survived, and you see the Jews are loyal. They never say, it's very interesting, that they never say, the writers say, even those who are unfavorable to the Jews, never say that some of the Jews are disloyal or that many of the Jews, a few perhaps, but certainly not very many. The great majority of the Jews are observant. And it's quite clear that they mean that the Jews are observant of Shabbat, they're observant of Kashrut, they're observant of the various customs of Judaism. Okay, so there I think you can see the picture of anti-Semitism on the part of governments. I repeat, yes, there are instances, but the instances are simply temporary. The Jews always come back. The power, the alliance, the vertical alliance is renewed. Now, how about popular anti-Semitism? The masses. Here it's a different story. The masses apparently dislike the Jews very, very much. We have here papyri. Again, I might say, is a magnificent collection of the papyri. All the papyri pertaining to the Jews in three volumes collected by Israeli scholars, Cherikover, Fuchs, and Stern. And you take a look at the papyri and you see the Jews are hated. Now, why are they hated? They're hated because the Jews have privileges which they don't have. The Jews have influence which they don't have. Now, why do the Jews have the privileges and the influence? Because the Jews are numerous, the Jews are united, the Jews have leadership, and I might say the Jews are very important to the government. The Jews are the backbone of a bureaucratic government. The Jews are the tax collectors, the Jews are the ones that keep records, the Jews are loyal, the Jews are in the army, the Jews are commanders-in-chief even of the army. You find that this hatred of the Jews manifests itself particularly in what we would today call a pogrom. Now, how do you define a pogrom? Remember there was a big discussion a few years ago in Crown Heights. Was that a pogrom? How do you define a pogrom? Well, certainly one of the ingredients of a pogrom is that the government is in cahoots with the people. The government, which could have stopped the pogrom, does not do so, but actually aids and abets the pogrom. Now, that's exactly what happened in the pogrom of the year 38 in Alexandria. Now, what happened in that case? The ruler of Rome at that time was Gaius Caligula. Gaius Caligula was a madman. There's no other word to use than that. Gaius Caligula decided that he deserved to be worshipped as God. He decided, therefore, that his statue should be brought into Jerusalem and into the temple itself. He decided that in other parts of the world he should be worshipped. Now what happened was, on these two fronts, in the land of Israel, the Jews simply refused to allow the statue to be brought in. They literally, Josephus describes this very vividly, they literally lay down and they offered their necks to the Roman governor of Syria, because Judea was part of Syria, Petronius, and they said, "We will not allow this. We simply will not allow this." And the Roman governor, you see again, what impresses the Roman governor is the unity, the loyalty of the Jews, and he says, "Well, there's no other way. We have to then go back to the emperor and tell him to rescind this order." So he writes to the emperor. Now you can imagine, if the governor writes to the emperor, "Don't allow your statue to be brought into the temple," what's going to be the result so far as that governor is concerned? That's going to be his head, and he's not going to last. But yet he did it. He was so impressed with the loyalty of the Jews. In the case of Alexandria, again, great Jewish community of Alexandria, we estimate the Jewish population of Alexandria at that particular time was about 40% of the population. In other words, there was a greater, and that was the largest city, I might say, in terms of population, Jewish population, in the world at that time. It was the New York City of its day. We estimate that there were 500,000 people living in Alexandria, of whom 40% were Jews, which would be about 200,000 Jews. There were more Jews, listen to this, there were more Jews living in Alexandria in the year 38 than there were Jews living in any city in the world until toward the end of the 19th century. You realize that? In other words, it was by far the largest Jewish community. And he then orders this Jewish community that they must worship the statue of Caligula. Now what happens is that, again, the Jews happen to have a leader. His name is Agrippa the First. Now Agrippa the First happens to make a trip to Rome at the very time when Petronius, the governor, sends this message to Caligula. And because Agrippa the First had been raised in Rome and had cultivated contacts with the family, the royal family, and had very good relations with Caligula, and I might say with the whole family, he's invited to a dinner by the emperor. The emperor is very much impressed. This friend of his from boyhood days comes, gives him a beautiful gift, and so on. And he turns to him and he says, "I would love to give you anything you wish. You name it and I'll give it to you." Now what do you suppose he thought that Agrippa would ask? Some more land, maybe some gifts of money, whatever it is, titles? No. Agrippa then turns to him and says, "I don't want to ask anything for myself. I will ask only that you rescind the order that you be worshipped." And because he had promised that he would listen to whatever had been asked of him, he rescinded the order. Now, I mention that because, again, I want to point out to you the importance of leadership, selflessness. That's the key. The fact is that Agrippa the First did not think of what he could gain for himself. And Agrippa the First, I might say, at that particular point, could have asked, since he was in a very precarious position. He had just been named as king of Judea. To come back to Judea with a title that had been given to him by the Roman Senate, that's not quite enough. Maybe he should have asked for Roman troops. Maybe he should have asked for some other thing. But he didn't. He asked for something for the Jewish people, and he was able to prevail. Now, the net result of this was that when Agrippa came back triumphantly to claim his throne, he passed through Alexandria. And in Alexandria, there was a parade in his honor. And the parade must have been a magnificent spectacle. He was himself dressed in royal clothes very richly, and so on and so forth. And it seems that the population, resented the influence of the Jews. These Jews have the ear of the emperor. They can get the emperor to reverse himself. And so they took a person who was an imbecile, they dressed him up like a king, and they addressed him as Marin, Lord. Right? As if to say, the Jews really of Alexandria are worshiping not the Roman king, but rather they are showing their loyalty to a Jewish king. Right? A riot ensues. And it so happens that the Roman governor, whose name is Flaccus, takes the side of the rioters. And that's a pogrom. Where he took the side of the rioters, did not stop the pogrom. And we hear that Jews are trampled to death. We hear that all kinds of indignities are imposed upon the Jewish leaders. And the fact is that it's only after the riot continues for some time that finally the ruler decides enough is enough. But then what is a very, very interesting is that the emperor decides that Flaccus, because he had not stopped the pogrom, has to be punished. And Flaccus is then recalled and is put to death. Now, again, this illustrates, I think, what happens when you have Jewish loyalty, Jewish unity, and Jewish leadership. The fact is that the pogrom is a pogrom that lasts only during that period of time, and the one who caused it or the one who permitted it to proceed is punished. If indeed you have at a later time in the year 66, when you have the outbreak of war against the Romans, as the Jews revolt against the Romans in the year 66, you have a number of cases of popular uprisings, particularly in Caesarea and in other places too, in Syria for example. Every one of these cases, you find that the government permits the uprising to continue because they say the Jews are revolting against the Roman Empire. If the Jews were not revolting against the Roman Empire, then they would presumably have put down such a revolt, or if they didn't put it down, they would have suffered the same penalty that the Roman governor of Egypt, Flaccus, did. Now, I want to deal now with a third type of anti-Semitism, and that is anti-Semitism on the part of intellectuals. Now, the first point that I would make is that the intellectuals during this period seem to have very little knowledge of Judaism. For example, they don't know where the Jews came from. So that, for example, Tacitus, who is otherwise very well informed, and who is a person who has access to archives, libraries, and so on, happens to be related to a very important family in Rome, at the beginning of the second century, writes a work called Histories, in the fifth book of which he comes to the war of the Jews against the Romans. And he says, well, since we're talking about this war, I should tell you something about the Jews, where the Jews come from. And he presents no fewer than six different theories as to the origin of the Jews. Most fantastic theories. The Jews, he says, are from Crete. The Jews are from Ethiopia. The Jews are from Asia Minor, and so on. The fact is that he doesn't know. And it apparently never occurred to him that he should ask Jews and find out. Why? Because apparently the Jews were isolated. The Jews apparently did not have relations with the non-Jews, or the non-Jewish intellectuals at least. And as a result, you have misinformation. So that, for example, you even have, and this is repeated, I might say, in writer after writer, even writers, incidentally, who are not anti-Jewish, repeat over and over again that the Jews observe a day called the Sabbath. Okay, that's correct. But they say the Sabbath is a day which is marked by fasting. Now, you and I know that that is not. I mean, apparently they've never attended a Kiddush. But what I'm saying is that the fact is that they really are misinformed. Or they have stories about the origin of the Jews. For example, there's a writer, Alexander Polyhistor, lived in the first century BCE. He says that Judea is so-called from the children of Semiramis, Judah and Idumea. Now, you know who Semiramis is? She's a Babylonian queen. I mean, that's a fantastic story, obviously not correct. Or there's a writer in the first century named Claudius Iulaeus who says the name Judea comes from Eudeus, who was one of the warriors who sprang from the dragon's teeth that were sown by Cadmus. You know the story about Cadmus of Phoenicia, who brought the Cadmean letters, the alphabet, to Thebes. So this Cadmus had children and so on, one of them, and sowed these teeth and so on, and from these teeth came a person named Eudeus, who was the origin of the name Judea. Or a writer, and most fantastic of all, a writer, Alexander Polyhistor, in the first century BCE, says, and listen to this, you won't believe it, but here is a person who is otherwise, he's called Polyhistor, incidentally, which means that he's a polymath, he knows a lot. He says, the laws of the Hebrews were composed by a woman. Do you hear that? The laws of the Hebrews were composed by a woman named Moso. Moses was a woman. Okay, now what I'm saying is that they apparently did not have much knowledge, or at least many of them, even most of them, did not have knowledge of the Jews. Now why not? Because the fact is that apparently the notion that of teaching Torah to Gentiles, as you know, it's not permitted to teach Torah to Gentiles, unless of course the person is a candidate for conversion. So apparently they were not candidates for conversion. They didn't know. Are forbidden to enter the temple. So therefore they speculate what's going on in the temple. Now do you realize that the so-called blood libel, you know what the blood libel is? The blood libel is something that you find before Christianity. We have two writers named Appian and Democritus who have a story that the Jews take a Greek, fatten him up, and then slaughter him. Right. So therefore, they simply don't know, and they start speculating what's going on. Or the Jews are said to worship an ass's head in the temple, right? Where'd they pick that up from? Because they didn't know. Nobody had ever been in the temple. Now, one of the problems which the intellectuals have with the Jews, it's a hard thing for us to understand, is that they look upon the Jews as being anti-intellectual. The Jews, they say, are people who believe anything. They'll believe anything. Why? I suppose the idea is Naseh comes before the Nishma. And they have the statement that the Jews, well, here's a statement of a writer named Hecateus who lived around 300 BCE and who is otherwise very favorable toward the Jews. The Jews, he says, are so docile that they fall to the ground and pay homage to the Nothing you can do about it. That's the way people are. What can we do about anti-Semitism? Apparently nothing. I would say that it's not quite so. I think that people do have minds, they do have intellect, and I believe that they can be taught. I don't say that it's easy. I don't say that it can be done overnight. But the greatest man who ever lived was Moshe Rabbeinu. He was a teacher, and he took a nation of slaves, and he taught them how to live as a free people. And I think that we can, because human beings are created in the image of God, can expect that people can be taught, people can be influenced. I think that it's a challenge, but the fact is that that is the function of education. I think that so far as we are concerned, and this I think is something that we can do more readily, there are, I believe, two great lessons which can be learned from this period. Number one, the lesson, I would say, there's a 614th commandment, and that commandment is, thou shalt not be weak. Yes, there were 70 or 72 people who apparently did know Greek, but probably not many more. No rabbi ever writes a treatise in Greek. Nobody. Throughout the whole period that we're talking about, the only people who write in Greek, the only Jews who write in Greek, are Jews who live in the diaspora, or if they live in Eretz Yisrael, they are Jews like Josephus, who incidentally doesn't write in Greek in Eretz Yisrael, but writes when he gets to Rome, right? Because in Rome itself, Greek was a very commonly spoken language. Or there are people like Herod. Now Herod, as you know, was not very, shall we say, very loyal to Judaism. So that's the kind of person who writes Greek. Yes. One way to accommodate the world would be to disappear. You know what I mean? I don't hear of too much anti-Semitism in Outer Mongolia. Seriously, I would say that if we want to remain, if we think we have some reason for continuing, yes, we have to expect that we're going to have these problems. We're going to be hated. I would even go further. I would say that one of the problems that the American Jewish community has is that, unfortunately, perhaps, we are loved. We are loved to the point where they even marry us. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that we should be hated, but sometimes tolerance carried to that level may be very, very dangerous and may lead to disappearance. Whatever happened, for example, just to give you an example from history, whatever happened to the Jews of China? Do you realize that there were Jews in China, not just a few thousand either, Jews in China for hundreds of years, finally disappeared. I think the last Jews, there's still, I think, a few people who claim they're Jews in China even today, but 1912. What happened to those Jews? The answer is that they assimilated. They intermarried, they were accepted, right? They accommodated. And the net result was that they're no longer here. Or for that matter, the Jews of the colonial period in this country. students and put them in 70 separate rooms, and they come out with exactly the same answers to all the questions and so on. That's a miracle. Now, the fact is that would seem to be implied here, right? There was a miracle, divinely ordained miracle, that they came out with exactly, even the changes. There are 13 changes that are mentioned there in Masechet Sofrim and Daf Tes Amud Aleph and Amud Beis. The fact is that those changes, or all the translators made exactly the same changes, right? And incidentally, there are other versions in Midrashim in which there are more changes, 18 changes, also exactly the same. So that's one version, miracle. And that's the version, incidentally, you find in Philo, in the work on the life of Moses. You find that also in the letter of Aristeas. You find it in Josephus, in the Antiquities. You find it in church fathers who tell this story as well. And yet, in the Tractate Sofrim, the day when the translation was completed is compared to the day of the golden calf, right? Obviously, it's a terrible, terrible thing. So how do you explain that? I would suggest the following, that originally, the translation served a very useful purpose. In other words, the translation may have been ordered by Ptolemy Philadelphus in the year 270 BCE. True. For his library. Okay. But the fact of the matter is, it was extremely important, not only for Ptolemy, but maybe even more so for the Jewish community, because the Jewish all its good and bad points, but the fact is it could be a very, very dangerous thing. The rabbis realized that, and then apparently came to the conclusion that the day when the translation was made was really like the day when the Israelites built the golden calf. And one final point, and that is that the translation known as the Septuagint was adopted by the church as the, not only the translation, but as the version of the Bible, to the point where, and it's hard for us to imagine this, but it is still so. If you read Justin Martyr, Justin Martyr was a Christian who lived in the early part of the second century. Justin Martyr writes a work called A Dialogue with Trypho. Now, who is Trypho? Trypho is a Jew. Some people have identified him with Rabbi Tarfon. And in this dialogue with the Jew, the Christian, Justin, says to the Jew, "Do you realize that I can prove to you that the predictions of the scriptures were fulfilled in this and that way, etc., etc.?" So the Jew says to him, "But you haven't understood the original correctly. After all, it doesn't say a virgin shall conceive. What does it say? It says Alma. Alma does not mean a virgin. Alma means a young woman. So therefore your idea of the virgin birth is really false, because it is based upon a translation. You took the Greek parthenos, which is the Greek word in the translation, and you therefore got a theological doctrine out of a false translation." And you know what the answer of Justin Martyr is? You just wouldn't believe it. He says, "You have falsified the original." In other words, you claim that your version is the original, but your version, meaning your Hebrew version, is itself a false version, and my Greek version is actually the original version, the correct version. Now, once the Christians claimed that, namely that the Septuagint had validity which actually transcended the validity of the Hebrew original, then that translation was really dangerous. And I think the rabbis understood that and said that that's the day, that's like the day when the golden calf was built.